Hello and welcome to Japan Explained. Nanso Satomi Hakkenden, or A Dog Warriors of Satomi Clan, is a masterpiece of Edo period literature. Published over the course of 28 years, it is a massive 9-volume, 180-chapter saga about the brotherhood of 8 warriors, descended by blood, but all spiritual descendants of the same pure-hearted princess. The book was not only hugely popular in its own time, but has gone on to become one of the most influential Japanese novels ever written. And today, let's try to find out how that happened. If Hakkenden has ever piqued your interest and you were wondering whether you could read it, you may have noticed that full English translations of the work does not yet exist. But good news, it's on its way. And today I'm joined by Glenn Whaley, the one and only person whose passion for the book turned into an attempt to translate it in English. The first two volumes are already available and have been a pleasure to read, so I can't wait for the next one. Together with Glenn, we'll be talking about the story of Hakkenden, the history behind the book, and how people in Edo period enjoyed it. And of course, we'll be discussing how Hakkenden has influenced Japanese culture, because chances are your favorite anime was inspired by it too. Glenn, thank you for taking on such a massive task, and thank you for being here. But first of all, could you please introduce yourself to the listeners?
Thank you. And thank you very much for having me on the podcast. I'm excited to talk with you today. So my name is Glenn Whaley, and I'm a professor of Japanese literature, technically associate professor of Japanese literature at the University of Oregon in the United States. And I don't know how familiar your listeners are, probably from all over. So that's on the west coast of the U.S. in the Northwest. Yeah, and so my specialty is literature of the period that Hakkenden comes from, so the Edo period or 17th through 19th centuries. And I'm really interested in basically popular fiction of the early and middle 19th century.
Perfect. So I think I have good questions for you then. First of all, I'm very interested why Hakkenden out of all the books that have been published in Edo period. And also it's such an influential book for Japanese history, Japanese culture, but at the same time, nobody have ever attempted to translate it fully into English. And I also know that you wrote a book about Hakkenden, so it's not your first encounter with the book either. I feel like you have some special connection to it.
Yeah, thank you. Great questions. So the first question, why Hakkenden? I can give basically two answers. And one is kind of a professional answer and one is a personal answer. So the professional answer is that, as I always tell my students, it's a very important novel. It was very influential on the course of fiction writing in Japan in the 19th century, not only in its own period, but also as Japan starts to modernize and westernize at the end of the 19th century. Literary figures, writers, educators at the time were really concerned with how should we revolutionize Japanese fiction to make it fit the new modern world. And because Hakkenden was so popular, everybody referred to it in these debates. So debates about how to modernize literature often took the form of, do we approve of Hakkenden or do we disapprove of it? Do we need to preserve it or do we need to reject it? So the professional answer for why Hakkenden is it's very important, and I wanted to be able to convey that to my students and my classes and to the world at large. The personal reason is because ever since I first read it, or actually before I started reading it and was just hearing about it and reading about it, I've loved it. I find it an amazingly exciting story, beautifully written, full of amazing plot twists, memorable characters and incidents. And I was just so enthralled by it that I wanted to translate it and let other people share that experience. And so that's sort of your second question, I guess. My personal connection, my first scholarly research, so my dissertation and then the book that came out of my dissertation was about this. was about Hakken dance. So I was trying to explore its importance, its influence, what's going on in the book. So I have this connection to it as a researcher and a scholar since my graduate student days. And for me, translating it was kind of an outgrowth of that. I always knew that I wanted to not just write about it, but translate it. And why has nobody done it before? Because it is so long. It is perhaps the longest novel in world literature. You know, you look that topic up on Wikipedia and there's lots of different ways to define that, but it's a very long novel. It was serialized over a period of almost 30 years. The modern Japanese edition is about 6,000 pages. It's 180 chapters. It's just tremendously long. And I think that, if nothing else, every translator before me, a chapter here or a chapter there would be translated, but who's going to be crazy enough to take on the whole thing? Well, I was crazy enough to try.
It's always good to find this one crazy person who would actually do the thing. Honestly, I'm very happy. I have also heard and read about Hakken Dance since pretty much the moment I started being interested in Japan. It's everywhere, but you obviously can't read it in Japanese right away. There are no alternatives, yet anywhere you look, like theater, ukiyo-e, even anime, you see Hakken Dance there. Now, getting closer to the book itself, the beginning of it is another book, if I understand correctly. In the introduction, you've mentioned that Baikin translated Suikoden and based Hakkenden on it. Could you please tell us a bit about the Suikoden and the parallels between the two books?
Yes. He, in turn, was fascinated with the popular fiction of China. And, you know, as I'm sure many of your listeners know, Chinese culture has had a huge influence on Japanese culture pretty much since the beginning of recorded history. So the idea of a Japanese writer influenced by China, that's nothing new. But what was different about his generation and maybe the couple of generations before him is that they were starting to become aware not just of classical Chinese literature, so like Confucius or, you know, ancient things like that. They were becoming aware of the new popular fiction that had been produced in the late Ming Dynasty, even the early Qing Dynasty, that was continuing to be produced, and that was very different from these kinds of older classical works. It was adventure stories. It was often very large-scale adventure stories. And it was written in a language that was much closer to the spoken language of China. And that made it very difficult for Japanese readers because it wasn't the classical Chinese they were used to. It was funky and it behaved in weird ways. But at the same time, it gave them this tantalizing sense of China as an actual living society. And it told amazingly fascinating stories. And so the one that influenced him probably the most is a piece of Chinese fiction that in Japanese is called Suikoden. The original Chinese title is Shui Huzhuan. It gets translated in English as The Water Margin sometimes, or Heroes of the Marsh. There was an early 20th century translation by Pearl S. Buck that called it All Men Are Brothers. These are all referring to the same thing. And he was really fascinated by this. It's an amazing novel. It's been translated into English a couple of times, highly worth reading. Basically, it's this long adventure story about outlaws, 108 outlaws, who basically band together to live out in the wilderness, kind of like a very large Robin Hood type story. They sort of oppose the government. They have adventures. They save each other from various travails and trials. But they're also kind of bad guys, you know, they do rob people and they do, you know, highwaymen sort of thing. This started to become known in Japan and Baikin was fascinated by it. He did a partial translation of it into Japanese in about 1804, 5, 6, around there. And then he decided to do an adaptation of it into his own fiction. And he actually did a couple of different adaptations and other people were playing with it as well. But basically, Hakkenden is his largest attempt to adapt this into Japan. So the story of Hakkenden is set in Japan, and all the characters are Japanese, but a reader who's familiar with The Water Margin or Suikoden will recognize playful transformations of episodes from this Chinese original. So in a sense, it's his kind of creative adaptation or transformation of this work of Chinese fiction.
Wow, actually, it brings us very nicely to my next question. I wanted to ask, how did the audience interact with the book at the time it was published? Because on one hand, there are a lot of these playful adaptations of Suikoden, so you need to know the original to understand Hakkenden to the fullest. On the other hand, you mention in the introduction to the book that on grammatical level, it's more common with Japanese as it was written in the 12th century than as it was spoken in the 19th. So I imagine you needed to have some level of literacy, or maybe I'm wrong.
So this question of how people interacted with it is, it's a fascinating one, and it's got a number of answers. Let me start with the kind of language it's written in. So it's written in the pre-modern classical Japanese grammar, which was very different from the way people spoke. But for a literate person, that alone wouldn't have made it tremendously difficult, because all fiction in Japan and most prose of any kind in Japan was written with this classical language until the last decades of the 19th century. So part of Japan's modernization was this, at the time, revolutionary idea that you could write like you spoke. That may seem obvious to us today, but that was not obvious at all to people in East Asia or many parts of the world in the pre-modern period. You know, we all speak very strangely, and especially in a pre-modern period when travel isn't as easy, people three villages over might speak a very different language than what you speak, and never mind halfway across the country, right? So the idea of, if you were to write like you speak, nobody but your neighbors would be able to understand it. So people took it for granted that when you write in this sort of standardized, to some extent, artificial language that everybody should be able to understand. It takes some education to understand it, but once you've done it, it's kind of common, right? Kind of universal. And so that was the way people wrote in Japan in his day. You needed to be educated enough to read, but if you were literate, you would be able to make some sense of this. That being said, Bakin was a very challenging prose stylist. He liked to throw in lots of references to Chinese classics, to Japanese classics, and he liked to do a lot of wordplay, including bringing in words not just from classical Chinese, but from this kind of spoken or quasi-spoken Chinese that he was learning from Suikoden. So if you're reading through Hakkenden, if you're, say, a reader in 1835 who's reading through this, there will be like moments where you're not quite sure what's going on because he's using very strange terminology. So it's got this flavor of semi-exoticism that's happening at the same time that it would be familiar. That being said, he was very conscious that he was writing for a paying audience, writing to make money. He was trying to make a living at this. And so he knew he couldn't completely alienate his audience. He wanted to challenge them to educate themselves more, but he always tried to leave a way for people to appreciate it on another level. And this is going to get into some of the slight details of how Japanese was written on the page. Some of your listeners will probably know that, you know, Japanese uses Chinese characters as well as Japanese characters. The Japanese characters are purely phonetic. You see it, you know how it's pronounced. A Chinese character might be pronounced two or three different ways, depending on the context. And so often, Japanese writing will have a little phonetic character next to the Chinese character to tell people how to read it. Not always, you know, once you're out of college in Japan, you're supposed to know all this stuff. And so they tend to take off the training wheels. But, you know, a text for a beginning reader will have these. He used that on pretty much every Chinese character in the book, which means that someone could just ignore all the Chinese characters, simply read the pronunciations and get some level of the story. What this also means, scholars in Japan have shown quite convincingly that there was an audience for books in Japan in the 19th century among people who couldn't read. There was a practice of communal reading aloud. Basically, a family might be sitting around in the evening, and one person might read a book, and the other people are listening to that while they're doing chores. And so people who couldn't necessarily read themselves would still be able to, you know, hear the story as it's being read, consume it, get involved in it. And so he knows this is going to happen. So he takes care that if you're just hearing this set of pronunciation cues, you're still getting something out of the story. So there's multiple levels on which people could have interacted with this.
Wow. I didn't realize he'd put so much care into it, because a lot of times when you see Kanbun, the old Japanese text, it's hard to understand it even when you see the reading next to it. But he really made sure that even people who just hear the text can understand what's going on.
Yes, that was important to him, yeah.
And on the other hand, why I'm interested in how people interacted with the book is that it was published for 28 years. You might have just learned how to read by the beginning, and then you're already a pretty old person when you finish it. People were actually waiting every year, and sometimes more than a year. Do you know a bit more about that?
So that does seem to be the case. I don't have, unfortunately, I don't think we know of any real diaries by readers at the time where they talk about, I was waiting for the new installment to come out. Joaquin did exchange letters with some of his most dedicated readers, and they're clearly waiting for new installments to come out. They're kind of special cases. They're usually very accomplished intellectuals on their own, right? Your average reader, it's really tough to say, but he sort of, I think he knows that people are waiting for this because he sort of talks about this, right? Sometimes in his private letters and diaries. He also sort of laments near the end of the book's run. He talks about how there were no doubt fans who were super into this book in its early years, but who died before ever seeing it come to a conclusion. On the other hand, he knows people who like raised their children on this book, and this book taught their children moral lessons. And so it's great to be part of people's growing up. So, you know, that's the author himself talking. Who knows whether he's making this up, but probably not. I mean, that's the kind of thing one would expect to happen. Another complication of this, you know, we're accustomed to being able to order any book that we want to through Amazon or some other online site. There were used bookstores in his period, but of course, no Amazon. So he runs into the issue, I think, pretty frequently of people coming into the middle, and they may or may not be able to track down earlier installments of this. There were ways you could do it, but he couldn't always assume that everybody who's reading this installment had read the previous installment. And so I'll catch him doing a lot of summarizing as the plot goes on. Part two has some of that. Future parts in the translation will notice that, you know, characters will meet each other after being separated for a long time, and they'll tell each other their adventures. And the reader, if you've been reading from the beginning, you're like, yes, yes, I remember all that. Why do we have to spend 5 pages summarizing my adventures? But I think he's doing that because he knows readers might not have access to chapter, you know, 35 when this happened. So he has to do this. He's making allowances, in other words, for people who are coming in the middle.
The more I learned, the more really thought he put into every book to make sure that people keep buying it, keep reading it, they keep enjoying it. And seems like people in Edo really enjoyed it because it was made into kabuki plays, and later I know there were parodies of the book published also. So what was the biggest key, except for Baikin's work actually, that he put into making the book likable? What were the major things that people loved about the book?
Right. I think it's basically that the story is so exciting. If we were to ask him, he would say it's the moral lessons, because he was very concerned with making sure that his work represented proper values. There's reasons why he did this, but he would want to say people are loving the story because the heroes are good guys, the villains are bad guys, and I show how good triumphs over evil, right? And some people were probably reading it for that, but I think more than that, he was just a natural storyteller. The plot itself is so full of twists and turns, and yet so full of color. I mean, there's just so much adventure. There's monsters of almost every imaginable type. There are shapeshifters. There are ghosts. There are magicians, wizards. There are pirates. There are land bandits. There's just everything you can imagine. You're constantly being pulled along by the press of events. That, in turn, I think, made it very adaptable to other media. And I'm glad you bring up, you know, it was on the stage. There were kabuki plays about it. There were adaptations of it into other kinds of print. There was a kind of fiction that people now compare to graphic novels or comic books that was heavily illustrated. There were two or three adaptations of Hakkenden into that medium. So that's possible because the story itself is what can transfer, right? You can take away his very careful wordplay and his elegant moral constructions. And if you just focus on the story, it's still exciting and that can be transferred to other media. And a lot of, to go back to your earlier question, how did people interact with this? A lot of people interacted with it through adaptations, even back in Bakinzo Day. They might've been aware of Hakkenden, but primarily as a kabuki play or as a piece of, you know, graphic novel type fiction, which, as you mentioned at the outset, it still is today. Hakkenden is still influential today, even though very few people actually read the original. It's still influential because it gets made into manga and anime and film and TV shows. And there's been an opera about Hakkenden. There's new kabuki versions. It's just everywhere still. Yeah.
Right. Just today, I saw parts of a kabuki play based on Hakkenden, and they've obviously shortened the story because it's far too long even for the extra long plays of the old days, and made the characters meet earlier or on a slightly different setting. But I can see why the audience loved it. There are so many fight scenes, there are energetic dialogues, the beads are not really beads anymore, they're like tennis balls that everyone is carrying around. There are birthmarks on the characters, so many visual details that would keep you engaged. Ah, and magic swords. You just cannot not love it.
Right, right. Yeah, magic swords. I mean, we have magical items. So my one of my mentors, Japanese scholar who used to teach at Senshu University in Kawasaki, she liked to compare it to The Lord of the Rings, if you're familiar with that. And it's just a very tremendously long epic full of magical items and magical people and monsters. And, you know, I'm not sure how far the comparison really goes, but that was what she liked to compare it to for her students.
I also heard the comparison to Lord of the Rings, and it kind of rings the bell because you have all these people living their lives, and then at some point they realize they're part of something bigger and they join this brotherhood, and then they go on the adventure together, meeting more people along the way, and then like there is one big final boss waiting for them.
Yes, there is. Yes, yes. Yeah, and it's this brotherhood, you know? So it's heroes, but as you say, they form this brotherhood that they realized was kind of predetermined for them. They were fated to become, to find each other, right? And one, I think this is actually one of Bakin's real genius moments. The Chinese original that he's working from, The Water Margin, also has this brotherhood, but there are 108 of them. That's a lot of characters to keep track of. And it's a lot of relationships to keep track of if you're trying to, you know, enjoy it for this brotherhood. He simplifies that to 8. And 8 is much more manageable. We get to know these 8 heroes. So in part 2, we haven't even met them all yet, but we get to know them really well over the course of the story. And it's very easy to keep track of their relationships to each other and each one of their backstories. And so we get to savor not just the individual heroics, but how they work as a team, how they respect each other and how they work together. And so when they're separated, we feel that, oh, that's painful that they're separated. Or when they discover each other, we, the audience, feel this great moment of like joy, fulfillment.
While we're speaking of adaptations, what are your personal favorites? Because there it's on there, movies, anime, kabuki plays, books, anything.
So I have to confess that I am aware of this vast body of adaptations. And I've been slowly sort of acquiring these on my own, but I have in mind that eventually I want to write an essay that's a guide to these, but I've been sort of intentionally avoiding it until that point. So each volume of the translation is going to have a separate introduction where I talk a little bit about some different topic for every volume. And I'm hoping that, not hoping, I'm planning for one of the future volumes to specifically address this question of adaptations into other media. And because I want to sort of do it in a concentrated fashion, then I've been intentionally avoiding. So I know, for example, that there's an anime right now that's super popular called Hakken den Tōhō no Ibun, or Eight Dogs of the East, or something like that. That seems to be what comes up a lot when I Google Hakken den, and I'm aware of it, but I haven't been reading it. So I don't really have a favorite, except the one that most intrigues me is the one that is least available. So in the early 70s, NHK did a puppet adaptation of Hakken den, and mostly it does not survive. It was super popular. Every kid in the 70s watched it. I, of course, missed it. I was growing up in the US at the time. But everybody like my age or a little bit older in Japan, whenever I say I'm working on Eight Dogs or Hakken den, they all say, oh, I loved the puppet show. But NHK, kind of like other state media, doesn't always save its old productions. So these episodes don't survive. I think one or two have been uncovered in archives, but it's not available. So I would love to be able to watch the whole thing and understand what other people of my generation got from it. It's not really possible. So I need to find somebody who writes memoirs of their memories of that show or something.
Yeah, that's a pity, honestly. And since you started speaking about Japanese audience enjoying Hakken den through this puppet show, what do they think of Hakken den? What is the Hakken den for the modern Japanese reader or somebody who watched or read one of adaptations?
Yeah, I again think it comes down to these hero stories. And I think the connection with dogs is probably crucial as well. So the title I've chosen for it in English is Eight Dogs. Hakken den, the Japanese title, translates to the legend of the eight dogs or the story of the eight dogs. They're not literally dogs. What they are, these eight heroes, are the sort of spiritual descendants or even reincarnations of the children of princess from a daimyo family or a noble family and her family dog. The princess and the dog have only chaste moral relations. Spiritually, however, this all happens in part one of the book. Spiritually, however, she becomes pregnant with the dog's children. She's horrified when she finds this out, kills herself, and these eight spirits fly off and are reborn as these eight warriors. And throughout the book, they're sort of called the dog warriors. They each have dog or inu in their last names. And so even though they look 100% human, they're all conscious that on some level, they're also descended from a dog. And then in the story, we have lots of emphasis on animals that come up. Pet dogs, pet cats come up all the time. And so I think readers are constantly being encouraged to almost subconsciously associate these guys, these heroes, with animals and specifically with dogs, which opens the door in adaptations to all sorts of use of dogs and animals. And one of my favorite, I come back to a favorite, it's not technically an adaptation of Hakken den, but it has huge elements of Hakken den in it, is the anime and manga Inuyasha, which is not, again, it's not the story of Hakken den, but we've got this main hero character who's sort of descended from this magical dog. We have the heroine on her quest not to collect these eight beads, but one bead that's been shattered into multiple parts. We have magic sword, we have quest, we have magical companions. There's a lot of Hakken den in Inuyasha. And I think what allows the creator of that, her creative agency, is the idea the elements are dogs, swords, adventure, and magical beads, right? And from that, she tells a new story, but you can clearly feel the relation to the original.
Actually, I read in your introduction about Inuyasha and also about Dragon Ball. That was one quite unusual, and it's super popular in Japan, like even now, even though it's pretty old anime.
Yeah, and that one too. That's even less close to Hakken den, but the idea of these
magic beads.
Yeah, this visual hook, I guess, of these beads with magical powers, and that they may have, you know, characters written on them or specific character significance, right? So he's like a writer who tells a good story, but he's also got these really potent things that come up in the story that the story is hooked onto that capture people's imaginations. Beads, dogs are probably the two biggest, yeah.
And do you have any other examples? Because these two are really big and I think a lot of people know them, but they never imagined they were connected to Hakken den. And I feel like this is something that happens a lot in anime, for example, that you can watch it, you can enjoy it, and then if you learn a bit more about Japan, you're like, oh wow, there was a connection to this and that, and they also mentioned these things. So if there are some other examples, would be really cool to hear.
Yeah, those are the two big ones that come to mind that don't have any specific connection or explicit connection. There might be others. My knowledge of anime, I'm a fan, but I don't pretend to the same kind of encyclopedic knowledge that some people have. So there's another another work that I did watch that is kind of, I thought it was going to be a more explicit adaptation, and it turned out to not have much in common with it except for a couple of motifs. So it's probably better to put it in the same category. It was called Fuse, I think. So F-U-S-E is the name of the princess who is sort of the spiritual mother of these dog warriors. But there was an anime a number of years ago that sort of uses the word Fuse as the name for a kind of semi, almost like werewolf-like, weredog-like race of hunters in this fantasy world. So it's clearly thinking of Hakendem, but the story is nowhere close to it. So that's maybe the one other thing that really springs to mind.
And while we're on visuals, I should have asked it earlier, but just came to my mind that Bakin is also very particular about illustrations. He writes how he is frustrated that the artist didn't do exactly what he wanted, and I guess it continues into the next books too, right?
Yes.
You say that in one of the introductions again that Hakenden demands visual literacy of its readers. Maybe you can a bit specify on that.
Yeah, that is something that I'm really excited to be able to emphasize in this translation. And I'm so grateful to the press that I'm working with, that they're willing to reproduce all of these illustrations and reproduce them full page with really good quality. Because it really was almost as much of a visual experience as a textual experience. And the reasons for that, I mentioned earlier that there was a kind of genre of popular fiction that was kind of like the graphic novel or the comic book of today that was heavily illustrated with text involved as well. And that was the most popular form of reading material. He came out of those, actually. So he did a lot of those early in his career, and he kept writing those all the way to the end of his career. And that was really how he made his living. And things like Hakenden, as popular as they were never as popular as the comic books, basically. And probably every listener can imagine that sort of situation, right? So he knows that readers are probably coming to his work with the experience of these heavily graphic, heavily illustrated pieces of fiction. He is used to writing for them. So he's used to thinking visually, even though he's not a good artist himself. And many of the artists that he's working with in the graphic novels are also illustrating his straight novels like Hakenden. So the illustrators who work in this are the same people who are doing these illustrations for these graphic novel type things. And so he's approaching Hakenden as, I think, you know, it's a much more textually sophisticated work than these graphic novels, but the logic of the way the illustrations fit in is fairly similar. They're not just decorations. He's thinking from the start, here's my story. We're going to have two illustrations per chapter. This is what I want those illustrations to show. And he'll actually do draft illustrations, which he'll send to the illustrators, which they make look good. And they can change details. And sometimes they'll change details he doesn't want changed. He'll gripe because he's chosen this detail, not just because he thinks it looks good, but because it might have a significance in the story later on. And when I say that it demands visual literacy, it demands people looking at these not just as pretty illustrations, but as things that are carrying information that we're going to need in order to make sense of the story. And one example that comes up in part two is a really, really interesting one. So I mentioned there's this magic sword, right? That the character sort of, it belongs to one of the dog warriors and it ends up with another one and it sort of changes hands for a while. And it sort of links the story episodes together in a way, particularly in part two where it's first introduced. This is a sword called Rainmaker. And it's magic in that it has the power when it's drawn, it emits this sort of fine mist that kind of dampens the battlefield. And sometimes it's described as like this thick fog, which allows the wielder of the sword to either escape or sneak up on enemies. In another scene later in the book, it turns the battlefield into like this field of mud so he can escape. Also, it's mentioned that it's self-cleaning, right? Because it emits this water. Basically, you don't have to wipe the blood away. It cleans itself, which is kind of funny, I think. But in one of the early illustrations of this, we see the guy holding the sword and we see this kind of cloud of mist arising from the sword. And if you look carefully, you can see this white dragon in the mist. This is never mentioned in the story at all. Turns out there's a white dragon that comes up in the first volume, but it's never explained whether that white dragon and this white dragon are the same. It's just there. And so the reader is left to make of that what they will. Do we decide that this is somehow the same dragon that we saw back in chapter one? Or is it different? Is it just a reminder of that? Does the sword somehow have a dragon spirit within it? Or what's going on here? We don't know, and it's never explained. And so if you're not paying attention to the illustration, you might miss this entire other dimension of play that he's engaging.
Yeah, or maybe it was planned initially, but never.
That could be. He may have meant to come back to it and just forgot about it or decided that didn't fit with his later plans. Yeah, it's really, really intriguing.
Yeah, because at least in the translations, illustrations come a bit earlier than the text describing them. So you first see it and you kind of start thinking, what can it be? Like, you can see which characters they are, and sometimes you didn't even meet them yet.
And there's a really good example of that. One of my favorite illustrations of the whole book is in part one, where at a certain point, we're going to be told a story about a dog that's being raised by a tanuki. If your readers know, this is this kind of yokai or monster that's kind of shape-shifting and kind of has magical powers. And so because this dog is raised by this tanuki, the dog turns out to be very special, right? Two pages before we get to that, we're just reading through the text, and we see this thin line of smoke or mist hovering over the text. And then we turn the page, and that line of smoke continues, and then it connects down to the dog and the tanuki. So basically, we've got this, not even a full illustration, just a piece of an illustration that's foreshadowing for us. Two pages before, something spooky is going to happen here. We turn the page and we land on it. It's this really creative moment that tells us that it's more than just text and illustration. It's always conceived as one unit.
So it's not just a book that can exist with or without illustrations. It's a complete work of text and art. Back to the present day, we've talked about how Häkkinen was perceived by readers of the Edo period and by modern Japanese audiences, but what about the modern foreign reader? I know you've put a lot of work into conveying not only the story, but also the little tricks Viking used to make it so engaging. I imagine that must have been hard, but maybe you could share some of the tricks you used.
So I've sort of set myself this impossible task of making the translation both entertaining. I really want the reader to feel pleasure reading it, the same pleasure I had in reading it. But at the same time, as a scholar, I'm noticing that he's doing all of these things that are really interesting, difficult, and that don't necessarily have close analogs in other literatures. And I want to also somehow bring those in there. And those could be completely opposite purposes, right? One prominent example, and I talk about it in the introduction to the first volume, it was pretty normal for stage plays in this day to deliver some of the lines in meter, kind of like the way Shakespeare did in Elizabethan drama in English. And I know this happened in other European languages. So many plays would have lines, you know, at a high emotional moment spoken in meter. The meter in Japanese is basically haiku meter. So five syllables, seven syllables, five syllables, and it would just alternate back and forth. And he does this on the page. So sometimes when characters, you know, it's a moment of high tragedy, not just their speech, but his narration will shift into meter, and it looks the same on the page. So if you're not paying attention, you'll never notice, but it shifts into this alternating lines of five and seven syllables. And it's very beautiful. And this was one of the things that for later generations was most memorable about this, because people stopped doing this later in the 19th century. You don't find this in modern novels. That doesn't feel like a modern novel sort of thing. But people remembered that he did that and that was special. And I wanted to somehow account for this because it's such a famous feature of his writing. How do you do this? There's no way you can do this that's not going to sort of alienate the modern reader, right? Because the modern reader, we don't expect that. And it might get in the way, right? It might knock people out of being engaged with the story in the moment, right? You don't always want people to step back and remember, oh, I'm just reading a piece of fiction. You want them immersed in it, right? So these could be in conflict with each other, these goals, but still I wanted to sort of do both. So for the moments of meter, I decided to rather than making it read like a haiku, to try to take English iambic pentameter, which is what Shakespeare wrote in. And I don't think I'm Shakespeare. People always say, what do you think you are, Shakespeare? No, it's not like that. But if I can sort of hint at that sort of register, then maybe people will feel at least a little bit of, the tone is more elevated here. It's more poetic here. And that A corresponds to something in the original. So as a scholar, I've made a point there that we could talk about in a classroom. But hopefully it also contributes to the reader's experience. It both is unnatural, but at the same time, kind of natural, so that it doesn't completely knock them out of the story. At least that's one of the tricks I'm trying to use.
I think you are mastering it, because as you read through the book, you clearly see how the style of the narration changes depending on what's going on. Like the war chronicle sounds more like a samurai tale, and then the more lyric part about Princess Fusa sounds completely different from that. And all the scenes of like country life and the battles, they also have their own touch. So you're totally managing it, don't worry. as a reader, I'm very happy.
I'm really glad to hear that, because that's one of the things I was most nervous about before the first volume was published, is anybody going to get this, or is everybody going to be like, this is you know, I teach this in my classes, and of course, you know, not all undergraduates are willing to take the time to deal with all this. So I got mixed reviews in classrooms, so I'm glad that some readers are liking it.
And I'm going to start to slowly wrap it up. And while we are on the books and translations and the writing styles, I wanted to ask you which books you would put in the same kind of high rank as Häkkinen then, because you said that it's one of the most entertaining works of fiction ever written. And which other works of fiction are as entertaining to your opinion?
For me, like in terms of world literature, I would definitely say you got to look at The Water Margin. So Suikoden, I mean, Bakin was obsessed with this book his whole life, and with good reason. It is. And once you know both Häkkinen and Suikoden, then the differences are just as entertaining as the similarities. But Suikoden in its own right, The Water Margin, just a fantastic book. And other works of Chinese popular fiction from the period, so The Plum and the Golden Vase, very different kind of story. That's erotic, verging into pornographic, but it's also very entertaining. Three Kingdoms, Journey to the West. So those all sort of one category. I also like to compare this to Three Musketeers in a weird way, which is being serialized at kind of the same time on the other side of the globe, although that's like a daily newspaper serialization, and Bucky's going one installment a year. So that's, the pace of serialization is very different. But the similar kinds of, like, we're sort of engaging with history, we're sort of just going to make things up, and we're going to concentrate on these guys whose primary loyalties to each other, and they're trying to be loyal to their rulers, but sometimes their rulers are bad people, so then they come into conflict. There's a lot of weird coincidences in Eight Dogs and Three Musketeers, I find. So that I put in the same kind of bucket. And I'm a huge Lord of the Rings fan myself, and so some of the things that Tolkien does with his writing is, I mean, he's trying to capture the feeling of old epics like Norse and English epics in his writing as well. So he's stretching. It's a very entertaining story, but I remember the first time I tried to read it in junior high school, out of my depth. His language is too difficult. And so I feel some similarities there.
Okay, good. So in the end, you're kind of a fan of this type of book, well, with the heroes and...
Yeah, okay.
But yeah, they're all great works and all pretty long.
Pretty long, yeah. And I didn't even touch on... That's the other thing that he learns from The Water Margin, is long. We tend to associate Japan with the tiny masterpiece, right?
With minimalism, yes.
Yeah, minimalism, right? And haiku, 17 syllables, and we don't need any more than that to evoke a whole world. And there is absolutely that side of Japanese culture, but I think part of what originally fascinated me about Bakin is that there's this whole other side of mammoth, hugely long, excessive works. And there's the excess that you can also find in pre-modern and contemporary Japanese culture. And that's clearly what he responded to, but he was getting that from the water margin. The idea that you could have a book that's 100 chapters long, that like must have blown his mind and inspired him in all sorts of ways.
So I guess that's one also good thing that people nowadays can learn from Suikoden, that Japanese culture is not as monogenic as we often tend to think about it. You shouldn't put all Japanese culture in one box. Every period, every author had something in mind. It's all different, and you should also appreciate this difference. Which other things you think modern reader can learn from Hakkenden?
I've concentrated, because I always do, I'm obsessed with how entertaining it is. I've talked about its entertainment value, and I think that's really there. I do think that his moral teaching aspect is a hugely prominent part of the book. And I think it's a way that a modern reader can actually get into it. Because, you know, if we're looking at it for what it can tell us about the society that produced it, what did these people think was good and what did these people think was evil? And is it the same as us today or is it different? And, you know, I like to say, what if we substitute the word social justice for good? We're still just as concerned with questions of right and wrong in our entertainment today as he was in his day. How do these definitions differ? What were the things that he considered to be just and unjust? And how did he balance that with entertainment, right? And this is something that people are always concerned with today, right? You know, when does a film or a TV show go too far into moralizing and loses the entertainment value? Or when does the entertainment value conflict with the message? He's thinking of these things all the time. So, I mean, it can teach us what people of his day thought right and wrong was in society and how to pursue it. It can also teach us how a popular creator is balancing the demands of entertainment and, you know, serious moral ideas in their fiction. Pretty universal.
Yeah, and also from Hakkenden, you can learn about what people in Edo period also thought about what happened before the Edo period. Because the work itself is not set in Edo period, it's set in 15th century.
And he's constantly his narrator is constantly pointing that out, right? So he's writing from an age of peace, setting a story in an age of war. And he's constantly saying, and this is what it was like in the age of war. You know, this is the way samurai acted in this age of war. Things might be different now. Reader, remember that we're talking about, you know, so he's on one level, it is kind of a historical novel. He's not taking history too seriously, but it's there, and he's trying to evoke a different world for his readers and a different set of historical realities for them.
So there is a lot of things you can learn from the book, but actually currently it's my last question. There is one thing I want to know the most is when we will see volume 3.
So I'm working on it right now. So I've finished a draft translation of the entire book. And so what I'm doing now is for each new part of the publication, I'm going back to revise the translation, do some more annotations, write a new introduction. So I'm currently working on all of that for part 3. And I'm hoping that I can submit that to the publisher this summer, probably the end of the summer. And if all goes well and, you know, and they like it, then I'm hoping that sometime in 2025, probably the end of 2025, we might see part 3, maybe early 2026. So somewhere around there, fingers crossed. I'm hoping we can do these. There was about 3 years between part 1 and part 2, but I would like to shorten it to 2 years if possible, because I'm not getting any younger.
You're still young. You still have time. But if you have the draft already of all the work, how many volumes do you plan it to be?
I'm planning to make it 8 volumes, which is a nice number that corresponds to the 8 dogs. They're going to be of different lengths. So the 8th volume could be, you know, it's probably going to be long enough. We could split it into 2 or 3 if we wanted to. We'll see what the publisher says. But at the moment, they also agree 8 is a nice round number, memorable. So we'll kind of see.
Okay, well, it's very nice to know that, because I was worried, like, you know, Bakken's reader, they sometimes didn't survive till the end of the book. We will all survive. Probably all the listeners of this podcast will survive till the end of the publication.
Hopefully, yes. Yes, we will all hopefully survive to the end of the book.
Okay, very happy to hear that, and I'm really looking forward to volume 3. And as we are speaking, it's been a month since the volume 2 was released, so everyone who wants to read the second part and be as eager to see the third one as I am, then please order it. It's everywhere on Amazon and Cornell University Press and pretty much anywhere you buy your books. Thank you very much for talking with me today. I've learned a lot, and I'm sure the listeners have too.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to have the opportunity to talk with you and your listeners about this. As you can tell, I get very excited, so it's always fun. Thank you.
Now, to those of you who stayed until the end of the episode, thank you for being here. If you are new to the show, don't forget to subscribe and definitely check out the old episodes. For example, one about Tanuki, a shapeshifter that Glenn mentioned when talking about book illustrations. Talk to you soon. Bye.